So whenever you're ready, please take it away.
Great, thank you. Can people see my screen and can you hear me?
Yep, all looks good. Thanks.
All right, great. Thank you. Thank you so much for the invitation, and my apologies for not being able to be there in person. Yeah, so I'm going to talk about some results from some recent results from pulsar timing arrays, and in particular from NanoGrav and our European and Australian collaborators. And I will focus in the latter third of my talk on cosmological sources, including cosmic strings and inflation and phase transitions. So NanoGrav is the North American Nanohertz Observatory for Gravitational Waves. And this is about, it's actually currently about 250 students and scientists in the US and Canada that we're working to detect and characterize low frequency gravitational waves using a technique called pulsar timing. So as I mentioned a second ago, this is an international effort that involves partners in Europe, Australia, India, China, and South Africa, and we all formed the International Pulsar Timing Array. In NanoGrav, we were fortunate to become NSF, National Science Foundation Physics Frontier Center, in 2015, and we just renewed it exactly 1 year ago, that award. Can people see my mouse actually when I'm moving it around on the screen?
Yes, we can see it. Thanks.
Okay, great. Great. I just want to make sure if I'm pointing to things that people are able to see it. Great. Right. So in the talk we just heard about ground-based interferometers and also LISA. So what I'm showing here is a plot of the strain versus frequency for these experiments, and in addition, pulsar timing arrays, and also the CMB. And these are placed roughly in strain versus frequency in the strain versus frequency plot. So the pulsar timing arrays and space-based interferometers like LISA and ground-based instruments all work in the same using the same principle. Well, all we're doing is measuring changes in light travel time between objects due to the passage of gravitational waves. So for LIGO, it's sensitive to neutron star mergers and black hole mergers with masses between a few and a few tens of solar masses. And in the pulsar timing band, what we're sensitive to are supermassive black hole binaries. These are billion solar mass objects, and also a series of primordial gravitational wave sources that I will discuss. The most promising sources, as I mentioned, are supermassive binary black holes, and form binaries and then merge when galaxies collide. So galaxies have supermassive black holes at their centers, and when galaxies merge, the black holes at their centers eventually find one another, orbit around one another, emitting gravitational waves, and eventually merge. And the idea, or the paradigm for galaxy evolution, is that it proceeds through mergers. So early on in the universe, you have small, kind of irregular, sort of smaller, fluffier galaxies that you can see, say, if you look at the Hubble Deep Field images. And these objects form, merge and form slightly larger galaxies in a hierarchical process that leads to the large structured objects that we see around us today, large structured galaxies that we see around us today. And in each of those mergers, the supermassive black holes at the center of galaxies will find one another, orbit at each other, and then merge. And so doing, they produce gravitational waves. And starting from the bottom, the final merger of the supermassive black holes produces this blue trace here. This is what it looks like in our data. It's actually produces a burst with memory, what's called a burst with memory. And that's a step function in the metric perturbation, but what we measure is an integral of that. So in our data, it looks like a ramp. Well, before that, the black holes are orbiting around one another, emitting continuous waves in green, shown here in green. And then the sum of all the mergers, sum of all the signals of all the mergers that are occurring in the universe form a stochastic background, which is a red noise process, which I'll discuss in some detail later. That's shown up at the top in red. In addition, these are kind of our are most promising source, but there's other sources in the nanohertz band, including cosmic strings, inflation, and phase transitions in the early universe, and other things that we can test as well, performing gravitational wave tests of gravity, which I will also discuss right at the end of my talk. So I wanted to show a couple of slides about how our experiment works. Our detector is made up of two components. The first component is pulsars. It's a type of neutron star, very strong magnetic fields, they have radio beams that come out of the magnetic poles. And as the pulsars are orbiting, if the beam sweeps past the Earth, then what we see, we observe these pulsars as point sources of radio bursts. And so they're basically like clocks that are spread out throughout our galaxy. And pulsars are, as far as our experiment goes, we care about that. We care about their stability. We care about the regularity of these radio bursts that we use as clocks. But they're also interesting objects in their own right. They're very extreme objects, you know, 500,000 Earth masses in the region the size of a city, and with very, very large magnetic fields. So there's a lot of synergistic science that actually falls out of what we do that is unrelated to gravitational waves that is nevertheless very interesting. The second component of our detector is our radio telescopes. So we make our measurements with some of the most sensitive radio telescopes in the world. Up until December 2020, we were using the Arecibo Observatory. This is a 300-meter dish, which unfortunately collapsed in December 2020. We do have about 15 years of data from Arecibo, from this 300-meter dish, which we are currently using, and we will continue to use. And in fact, kind of anchors, future observations as well. So what we did when Arecibo collapsed was we moved as many of the pulsars as we could to the Greenback Telescope, which is the largest steerable radio telescope in the world. This is a 100-meter dish here, and also CHIME in Canada. So we are now doing daily observations of pulsars, also using CHIME data. We had to drop about seven of our. We were timing almost 80. I think 79 pulsars maybe, and now we're timing 72. So we had to drop a few because the 100-meter dish just can't compete for these seven pulsars, just couldn't compete with the 300 meters of Arecibo. And we also use the very large array as well. And I like to mention this because this is the reason I got very interested in pulsar timing experiments was I just think it's a very beautiful experiment. There's these objects out there, pulsars, there are clocks that are out spread out throughout the galaxy, and all we have to do to build a low frequency gravitational wave detector is to build a radio telescope and point it at these pulsars. And so I really love this idea, and I started working on this probably about 14 years ago or so. I wanted to tell you a little bit about the effect of a gravitational wave on radio pulses from pulsars. So here's a picture of a cartoon of a pulsar and the Earth, and the pulsar is in the direction p hat, and a gravitational wave is passing through in the direction omega hat. The gravitational waves will redshift and blueshift the train of pulses that are coming from the pulsar according to this formula that I've shown here. So the effect, the redshift or the blueshift, is proportional to the difference in the metric perturbation when the pulse is received on Earth. The pulses are received on Earth, and the difference of that with the metric perturbation of the pulsar when the pulse was emitted. And this is called the pulsar term, and this is called the Earth term. And then this difference is projected onto the line of sight that connects the pulsar and the Earth through products with PI and PJ here in the numerator. And then there's a geometric factor as well, which I can, if there are any questions about it, I can say a little bit more. But the important thing is the pulsar term and the term. So it's a sum of, or the difference rather, of the metric perturbation of the pulsar when the pulse is emitted and the mental perturbation on Earth when the pulse is received. And so as the gravitational wave is passing through, it's, you know, changing, it's redshifting and blue-shifting this train of pulses. So what we do in our experiment is we keep track of every rotation that the pulsar is performing over many years. And then we construct a timing model that predicts when a particular pulse from a pulsar will arrive at our radio telescope. And the error in our prediction is called the timing residual. And gravitational waves change the time of arrival of pulses, so we can look for gravitational waves in this timing residual data and the difference from when the pulse was expected to arrive or when it actually arrived. The timing model here contains a lot of very interesting information. So for example, you know, because we're keeping track of every rotation, we're effectively keeping track of the rotational phase of the pulsar. And so the timing model has one of the, when a pulse would arrive at the radio telescope on Earth will depend on, say, the rotational rate of the pulsar. The pulsar is also spinning down, so that's slowing down its rotation. That's also part of the timing model. The pulsar is in a certain location in the sky, so as the Earth rotates around the sun, when it's approaching the pulsar, the pulses are arriving a little bit later, and when it's moving away from the pulsar, the pulses are arriving a little bit later. So sky location is important. There's also a proper motion of the pulsar in the sky, so we model that as well. That's also part of the timing model. And finally, the pulsar that we're observing could also be in a binary. So there's a bunch of binary parameters. So we measure all of those things. We model all of that, and then we subtract all that out. And then in what's left over is we can search for gravitational waves because those will affect the time of arrival. And the reason our experiment is very sensitive and we can do this, we can measure gravitational waves using this experiment is because we can actually predict the arrival times of pulses from our best pulsars to a few tens of nanoseconds over, you know, 10, 15 years for our best pulsars. Now, it's not enough to look at a single pulsar. We want to observe a collection of pulsars, and that's because pulsars are not perfect clocks. The pulsars themselves are complicated. There's complicated astrophysics in the propagation. I'll say a little bit more about that later. The propagation of the radio pulses between the pulsar and the Earth. And so, what we want to do is observe an ensemble of pulsars and try to extract the correlated signal from the noise. And each of these pulsars that we are observing, you can think of as an arm of LIGO, if you like. So right now we're observing 72 pulsars, so we have a 72 arm detector measure gravitational waves. And gravitational waves will be correlated among different pulsars, and the correlation is shown down here. This is the Hellingson-Downs curve, where the deviation in the arrival time the correlation in the deviation of the arrival time of pulses is shown as a function of the angular separation between the pulsars. So when the pulsars are close together in the sky, they're maximally correlated as you move away. They are less correlated, and this is the signature. This is the signature that we search for in our data. So if we're looking for a stochastic background in particular, we are looking for evidence of correlations in the arrival time deviations relative to what we expected. Over the past 17 years, we have been putting together, we have been growing our data set very dramatically. So our five-year data set, which spanned between 2005 and 2010, had 17 pulsars, and that's shown down here. In our nine-year data set, we had 37 pulsars. We also improved the instrumentation, which resulted in improvements in the arrival time precision measurements of factors of 2 to 3 for a lot of our pulsars. In the 11-year data set, we had 45 pulsars in our release, and in the 12.5-year data set, which I will discuss the results of, we had 47 pulsars. And these are all shown here in this plot on the right. What you see on the y-axis here is basically just a list of pulsars in the order in which we've been adding them to the array. And so this shows this shows two things, just how dramatically we've increased the number of pulsars, which is very important, and I'll explain why that is shortly. And also in the large increase in the data that we need to analyze. What you'll notice here is that for each pulsar, we have two or more colors. Each of these points represents an epoch that we've taken a measurement at. We take measurements at two different frequencies because as the pulses propagate, as the radio pulses propagate from the pulsar to the Earth, they disperse because the interstellar medium is not a perfect vacuum. Moreover, that dispersion changes as a function of time. As the line of sight between the Earth and the pulsar is changing, and the interstellar medium is doing whatever it's doing between the Earth and the pulsar, the amount of electrons along the line of sight that connects the Earth and the pulsar is changing. And we have to perform a high SNR measurement of that, high signal to noise ratio measurement of that at every epoch that we make a measurement. And so we make measurements at two different frequencies, measure that dispersion effect, and subtract that. That's also part of the timing model, in fact. Okay, so you probably saw this about a year ago. We published the results of a stochastic background search, and it got a lot of media attention. And I will discuss the details of that result and some of the implications of this result. Before I do that, I wanted to talk a little bit about stochastic backgrounds and red noise processes. So stochastic backgrounds typically show up in our data as red noise processes. And these are noise processes that have more power at low frequencies than at high frequencies. So we plot the power spectrum of our timing residuals versus frequency. Here's some examples of different kinds of noise. If you have more power at low frequencies than at high frequencies, it's red noise. If we have the same power at all frequencies, this is white noise. And those are the two noises that show up, as far as we can tell, in our data. Some series of white noise processes and a series of red noise processes. And we don't seem to observe any blue noise in our data, which would be power at higher frequencies, more power at higher frequencies than at low frequencies. One of the reasons I showed you the equation earlier for the redshift is that I wanted to make a kind of a subtle, maybe somewhat subtle point about our experiment. And that is that we're sitting here on Earth and we're looking at 72 pulsars. They're hundreds to thousands of light years away. And I said that the net effect on our signal from the passage of a gravitational wave is the difference in the metric perturbation on the Earth and at the pulsars. Because these pulsars are thousands of light years away, the metric perturbation of the pulsar, the realization of the background that these pulsars are seeing, is different for all the pulsars. It's the same. The Earth term is the same for all pulsars, but the pulsar term is different for all pulsars. So the net result of that is that it's only the Earth term gravitational waves that are correlated among different pulsars. So this Hellinger-Downs curve that I showed you before, when we actually try to calculate it, there's big error bars on this curve, and those come not only from the measurement noise, radiometer noise in our radio telescopes, but also even if we're gravitational wave dominated, it's going to have big error bars because of this pulsar curve. This is red noise, uncorrelated piece, which is the pulsar term at the gravitational wave. So we have the same Earth term, which is the gravitational wave, which is the correlated signal that we look for, and a different pulsar term, gravitational waves, which is, if you end up dominated by this, then it's a source of red noise in our data. And in fact, one of the things that we showed a few years ago, almost 10 years ago now, is that early on in the experiment, when at early times, you're going to be white noise limited in the sense that radiometer noise limited. But as time goes on, because the stochastic background is a red noise process, eventually your lowest frequency bins will become gravitational wave dominated, and what the white noise is doesn't really matter so much anymore after a sufficiently long time, And in fact, the sensitivity is pulsar curve gravitational wave red noise dominated, meaning your ability to find these correlations is actually limited by the gravitational wave at the pulsar in that limit. And when you're in that regime, the best way to beat down the pulsar term red noise is to time as many pulsars as possible, more or less independently over time precision, so that you can beat down on this gravitational wave noise, that is the pulsar term, gravitational wave at the pulsar. Okay, so I wanted to we've been doing in NanoGrav, of course, we've been adding, this is why we're measuring, why we're adding pulsars to our array, as aggressively as we possibly can, so that we can, when the time comes, we have enough pulsars there to beat down on this pulsar term, and extract the gravitational wave correlations that are really just coming from the Earth time. And this is a really important part of our observing strategy. All right, so before I discuss the results, I wanted to talk a little bit about our model, or how we model our data. So I mentioned a few slides ago, I talked quite a bit about the timing model. This is the part that has all of, the pulsar rotational period, the period derivative, the binary parameters, the sky location, proper motion, all those things, yeah? So that's shown for each pulsar in green here, in each of these boxes, it's shown in green. In addition, each pulsar has a set of white noises. I've mentioned radiometer noise. There are other sources of white noise as well. And then possibly intrinsic red noise. And the intrinsic red noise could be, if there's turbulence in the interstellar medium, in each of, as I mentioned, we do a high signal-to-noise ratio measurement of the amount of the electron content along the line of sight at each epoch. We don't measure it perfectly, and if there's some residual leftover imperfectly measured electron content, call it dispersion measure. So there's an imperfectly measured dispersion measure, that and there's turbulence in the interstellar medium, and that can show up in our data as red noise, and that depends on the line of sight to each of the pulsars. So each pulsar will have a timing model, some sources of white noise, and one or more sources of red noise. And so we have, in the case of the 12 and a half year data set, we have 45 pulsars. And so we have 45 of these boxes, each of them with timing model white noise and red noise. And then in addition to that, we can add a common signal across all pulsars, which is possibly correlated if it's a gravitational wave. And the stochastic background in our data will first show up as a common red noise process. A red noise process with the same amplitude and spectral index. And as we wait longer and longer, and we add more pulsars, and we our experiments last longer, we can detect correlations in this red noise, in this gravitational wave red noise, if that is indeed what it is. So now to the stochastic background, 12 and a half year background results. So here's our boxes again with the intrinsic properties of each of the pulsars, and this red noise is we write it as an amplitude and a spectral index. So the power spectrum has it's A times F to the minus gamma, and each of these pulsars will have some its own individual A and gamma, say for the intrinsic red noise. And in addition to that, we have a common signal. So all pulsars, in addition to this intrinsic red noise that is that's different for each of the pulsars, will also have a common signal with an amplitude and a spectral index that is the same across all pulsars. And this is what we showed. Plots for in the 12 and a half year paper that we published about a year ago. The results for this common process, the amplitude and the spectral index that we measured, that was common to all pulsars. We measured it with very high significance, and it's shown here. It's shown at the bottom of the slide. In a couple of different ways. Just ignore the green traces here, just for the purposes of making the discussion a little easier. The orange line was a five frequency power law that we fit to the lowest five frequencies in our data set. We also allowed a broken power law fit where we fit to some number of frequencies that the data decided how many frequencies should be fit and then flattened out at high frequencies. And both of those, the blue and the orange fits, gave very similar results. So this is a plot of the amplitude versus the spectral index of this red noise process. And it's a very clear measurement of a common red noise process. So how clear? Well, to decide how clearly we measured it, we use the Bayes factor, which tells you how much more or less likely one model is compared to another model. So the first model that we start with in our analysis is a model that only has intrinsic pulsar noise. And that means that we only have these boxes here at the top that I started with. So that's our basic model. So that's this box over here. And then we compare it to a model that has a common amplitude process. And we this model. So we compare the model which just has these boxes at the top here to a model that has both sets of boxes. The Bayes factors that we measured for that were between 250 and 30,000, depending on exactly what you do. So this was a very clear measurement, as I mentioned, of a common same amplitude spectral index across all of our pulsars. So that's a good, that's an encouraging sign. What we really need to claim a gravitational wave detection is to measure correlations. And so then we ask the question, are there correlations for this process of this common amplitude process? Is it correlated across pulsars? For that we do again another Bayes factor comparison, where we look at different correlations and we compare a model with correlations. These are three different models that we looked at: monopole, dipole, and Hellings and Downs correlated process. And then we asked, how much is it preferred to, or how much are these models preferred to a model that where there's a common red noise process that is uncorrelated? And that's the key signature for gravitational waves. We can measure, common processes, but we can't say this is not some astrophysical process, some new astrophysical process unrelated to gravitational waves. We need to really measure the correlations to figure out whether that common process really is gravitational waves. So what we found for the Hellings and Downs correlations was a Bayes factor between 2 and 4. So 2 to 4, so 2 to 1 to 4 to 1 odds in favor of Hellings and Downs correlations in our data. We also looked, as I mentioned, for monopole correlations, the Bayes factors there were less than 1, and dipole correlations also less than 1. This means that the monopole correlations or dipole correlations are disfavored. What does a Bayes factor of 2 to 4 mean? Well, not really very much. If you look at the correlations now versus angular separation, I'll plot it here for the 11-year data set and the 12 and a half year data set shown down here. If you squint really hard, you might say, well, I kind of see something here, but really this is not a very significant measurement of the correlations at all. We did some simulations where what we did was do the equivalent of what LIGO does. So LIGO does time slides to assess the false alarm rates, to assess the chances of a non-gravitational wave to show up with a certain significance. We can do the same thing here. What we do is we phase shift our data. So we add phases, we add random phases to our data to produce that effect of time slides, basically. And we also can do sky scrambles, meaning we just put the pulsars in the wrong sky locations, basically. And that's what is shown here in blue and in orange. And with those two, we showed that a Bayes factor of 2 to 4 would show up in our data about 10% of the time. So this is nothing to write home about in terms of the correlations. But it's still interesting in the sense that we are seeing a common red noise process, and that is the first thing that we expect to see. But we don't know what this is. It's the first thing that we expect to see, I should say, if it is a gravitational wave background. But we can't say that that's what it is because there's not enough information in the correlations. There's no significant quadrupolar correlations. Although curiously, it did disfavor monopolar and dipolar correlations. That was interesting. Following that result, in the following year, three additional papers have come out. One from our European collaborators, another one from our Australian collaborators, the Parkes Pulsar Timing Array, and also in the latest International Pulsar Timing Array dataset, which all found a common red noise process with similar amplitude and spectral index. The neat thing about the IPTA analysis is that the IPTA analysis, because these are pretty difficult analyses to do, it only used the Nanograv 9-year data set. So because it's just very difficult for us to put our data sets together. It's a complicated process. And so these typically run pretty far behind. So these are results of our 12.5-year data set that we're talking about here. But the IPTA data set with Nanograv 9 years of Nanograv data shows the same results. And that's a curious thing as well, and really speaks to the power of all of us working together and combining our data sets and analyzing our data that way. So we are currently analyzing a 15-year data set that we're following up on this result, and we're collaborating with our international colleagues who have their own independent data sets. And we're working on a simultaneous publication with the Europeans and the Australians, and also the Indian Pulsar Timing Array. We're also collaborating on this. And what we're planning on doing is submitting three papers simultaneously with the results on each of our later data sets. And then we'll, the plan after that is to combine all of our data and produce an even more sensitive analysis. And the expected time of arrival here for this analysis, for these three simultaneous publications, is something like the end of 2022. So stay tuned. Okay, so what are we gonna do
Before you move on, I just had a quick question. So I was just wondering if you could say a little bit about what the alternative would be for this, common residual red noise if it's not a gravitational wave signal. If it turns out not to have the right spatial correlation, then what would the explanation be? Or what are the possibilities? Yeah.
That's a great question. There aren't great candidates for this. Because one candidate could be, for example, this leftover I mentioned that we make measurements of the electron density along the line of sight, right? And that is the interstellar medium, which has some turbulence. And I measured that could be a source of red noise. And that is, in fact, what we try to model with these red A's and gammas, some leftover intrinsic noise, maybe that is left over from this process. It's difficult to see how that would have the same amplitude and spectral index, because it depends on the line of sight to each of the pulsars, where presumably there's a different amount of electrons along that line of sight, a different amount of turbulence. Another possibility is intrinsic spin noise. So we know that slow pulsars exhibit very red intrinsic noises. We don't really understand where they might be coming from. We think maybe it's breaks in the crust that then restabilize. Or there was a really nice paper from a few years back from the European group, I think, where they showed that these slow pulsars, not millisecond pulsars, but slow pulsars do mode switching, where they will switch between different and that can result in a red noise process. So, but again, these are pulsar dependent, and they depend on things like the spin and the spin down rates of pulsars. To the best that we understand, depends on the properties of these pulsar properties, like the spin and the spin down. There aren't great candidates, but it's certainly possible to think that you know, if red noises are sufficiently similar enough, that they might appear like a common red noise process. Right. So we just don't know. There aren't great candidates, but we can't rule out some unknown thing that we just don't know about. Right. That isn't a gravitational wave. And so that's there is an upcoming paper by the Parks folks, which it's in internal circulation. So I don't think I'm able to disclose what the results are, but it deals exactly with this question of whether, you know, how, you know, do the data prefer, you know, a single red noise process or a bunch of individual red noise processes that are similar-ish? Does that answer your question?
Yeah, great. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and by the way, please feel free to interrupt and ask questions. Of course, I think it's more it's certainly more fun for you, for me, and it might be more fun for you as well. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about the astrophysical inference. So what are we going to do when we detect the background? What are we going to be able to say about supermassive black holes? I just wanted to talk a little bit about that. So here's a plot of the characteristic strain as a function of frequency. And here's, you know, the black line is our, I think that's our upper limit from, this is from the 9-year paper, from our 9-year analysis paper. And then the green, orange, and blue show different models. One of them has a turnover at low frequencies, the green one, depending on what assumptions you make about the binary black, supermassive black hole population. At high frequencies, the high frequency part of the spectrum comes from the regime where the supermassive black holes are really close by, right? So when they're very, very nearby, they're orbiting around one another very quickly, that's this region here. And the normalization of the spectrum at these frequencies has to do with, you know, what rates do galaxies merge? Do black holes stall? Do they really find each other? This is the so-called last parsec problem. What is the relationship between the mass of the black holes and the mass of the galaxies and the black holes that they host? This is the MM sigma or the MM Boltz relation. At low frequencies, when the black holes are further apart, their evolution is more likely to be determined by environmental effects. For example, if the distance between the two supermassive black holes is larger than the distance to the typical star, and the black holes are therefore at the core of the galaxy, and the black holes are therefore scattering stars, then they're not emitting as much energy into gravitational waves because they're losing some of that to scattering stars. So you could have something like a turnover at lower frequencies because of stellar scattering. Circumbinary disks have a similar effect. And so all in all, by trying to figure out, is there a turnover? Where is that turnover? What is the overall amplitude of the spectrum? We can solve the inverse problem and talk about galaxy merger rates, stalling fractions, MM sigma relations, and environmental effects. Basically, what do the cores of galaxies where black holes are merging look like? So we solve the inverse problem and understand all of these effects. In addition, you know, our simulations of supermassive binary black holes show that the spectrum at the very lowest frequencies is dominated by the emitting sources. But as you go to higher and higher frequencies, there's a chance that a supermassive black hole binary, either because it is very nearby or because it is very massive or both, is sticking up above the stochastic background. And the predictions for these individual systems that we would detect, say, as continuous waves that are sticking up above the stochastic background, they're more uncertain than for the background. But the simulation work indicates that we should discover our first individual systems around 2025 in a few years, a couple of years, and a handful of systems by 2030. And so this is a very, you know, it's very exciting. Because it presents the opportunity to do multi-messenger astronomy with them. And, you know, as opposed to LIGO and ground-based detectors where you know, black holes or the neutron stars merge, and then you can run out of time pretty quickly to do various kinds of follow-ups. Our systems are around for, you know, a million years. So we have a very long time to follow up and do our multi-messenger astrophysics with these continuous wave sources. I like to show this plot, and this is it's a nice segue to the previous talk that we just heard. This is redshift versus total mass for the system, and basically between LIGO, LISA, and pulsar timing arrays, we essentially cover the entire spectrum of supermassive black holes in the universe. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about supermassive black holes, and now I'm going to talk a little bit about more exotic sources. I don't know if there's any questions. I can't see people's hands, but I think now might be a good time to see if folks have questions.
Sorry, I have a question. It's online, so I'm not there physically. In the previous slide, what did you mean when you said that that the predictions for individual systems are more uncertain than the background? Do you not like that you get these peaks that are higher than the background?
What I meant to say, sorry, I didn't explain that very well. What I meant to say is that, you know, we only expect a handful, and so the sort of Poisson variations of that are very large. Does that answer your question?
Yes, that does. Thank you.
Yeah, great. Okay, great. So let's talk about cosmological sources. We've got about 15 minutes or so left. So let's press on. So as I mentioned, you know, our bread and butter source are supermassive binary black holes, and we expect to detect background from these supermassive black holes by in the first half of this decade, so in the next few years, and this will be followed by the detection of individual binaries. But what about cosmic strings, inflation, and phase transitions? How can we distinguish between different sources? If there is more than one stochastic background in our data, how can we detect it? How do we detect a stochastic background signal from other sources when we have a large foreground from supermassive binary black holes? And these sources are, of course, more speculative, but I think it's important to think about them because a positive detection would have very, very profound consequences. So let me start with inflation. This is the one that, in my mind, is the least speculative of the three. It's part of the standard cosmological paradigm. And so here's a plot from, at the bottom left here, is a plot from Paul Lasky and collaborators from 2016. We show omega versus frequency, and plotted are various inflationary spectra. The standard inflationary spectrum is shown here in green. And then there's some models also which have a blue spectrum in omega. I'm not an expert on these models, but I don't know how realistic these are. But I will focus just on the standard model of inflation in terms of making what we might be able to do with pulsar timing arrays and inflation. So what we did, this is from a couple of years ago. I was thinking about this with Joe Romano, and we just asked a few basic questions. So we looked at, you know, the power spectrum of use in the residuals. So I'm showing some formula here. I don't know if I'm guessing we will post the slides. I don't really want to go through these equations, but I just want to have them, show you that we do have them. So for standard inflation, the spectrum is basically flat. H naught is the Hubble parameter, and omega naught is the energy density in gravitational waves from inflation. And it's a very red red noise process. So it's F to the minus 5. So we can start with a few basic questions, like, how does the inflationary spectrum compare with the white noise in our timing residuals? And how does it compare with the supermassive binary black hole spectrum? So the first question is, suppose there's no background from supermassive black holes, and all we have is white noise in our timing residuals. When does the lowest frequency bin in our data become inflation dominated? And the answer is surprisingly soon. So here's a plot of the power spectrum versus frequency. Here in green, I'm showing, say the power spectrum for a pulsar, with an RMS, white noise RMS of 10 nanoseconds, right? That's better than, you know, our best pulsars are a few tens of nanoseconds, and 100 nanoseconds is sort of more representative of our standard pulsar. So we can ask, you know, what observational time does the inflationary spectrum start to creep up above this flat white noise spectrum? And the answer is surprisingly soon. If we have 10 nanoseconds of red noise with omega of 10 to the minus 14, now I know that the limit from omega is from CMB is 10 to the minus 15, but here it's raised to the power of 1/5, so it doesn't really matter too much. But the answer is surprisingly soon. If we didn't have a supermassive binary black hole background, it seems like we might be able to detect the inflationary background within, you know, a few decades of this experiment. And that sounds like a long time, but, you know, we've been at this already for almost 20 years. The second question is, but that's if there is nothing there. There's no stochastic background from supermassive black holes. If there is a stochastic background from supermassive black holes, then we can ask, well, how, you know, when will inflation dominate the lowest frequency band, if there is such a background? And we can look at a few, the blue lines here show the stochastic background from supermassive black holes. The red shows the stochastic background from inflation. It's a bit steeper. And so one could ask, well, when will this red line creep up? You know, how long do we have to wait before the lowest frequency band is dominated by inflation? The answer is never, really, in practice. It's like, you know, billion years for 50,000 years or something like that, depending on the amplitude of the background. So we'd have to wait a very long time. And this is again with the overly generous omega of 10 to the minus 14. So and it's raised to a different power here. So it's not. It's gonna be even much worse with 10 to the minus 15, which is the real upper limit that comes from CMB measurements.
Just to clarify for me, sorry.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So for your red curve, does that correspond to a tensor to scalar ratio of like 0.1 or so?
Yes.
Okay.
But is that? I'm sorry. The tensor to scalar ratio is related to omega, right?
Yeah. Okay. Well.
So it's a little bit more than that then, because I think the 0.1 is omega of 10 to the minus 15. I think.
Oh, so this is a tensor to scalar ratio of 1. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, it's a higher than 0.1. I don't remember the equation off the top of my head right now, but this is an even more generous one. Yeah. So even with this very generous assumption for the amplitude of the background from inflation, we're still never going to see it. Okay. Right, with this. I know for a fact, I think there are probably people in the audience that can have a better memory of how omega and the tensor to scalar ratio relate. I don't remember right now off the top of my head. Okay, I did mention that there are environmental effects that can turn over the spectrum. And so I've shown that here in blue. And so here's the high frequency part where the supermassive black holes are evolving purely gravitationally. And here is the most pessimistic in terms of supermassive black holes, where the black holes are scattering stars, and that turns over the spectrum to a 1 over F. And again, with the same set of numbers, with a very optimistic assumption of 10 to the minus 14 for omega naught. The answer is probably not. I think this might be worth looking into with a little bit more detail, because the numbers are, not many orders of magnitude away. Remember, this is a very crude question, right? All we're asking is, when is the lowest frequency dominated by inflation, right? And so this is not like when will we make it, when will it be detected or anything like that. But if the numbers are anywhere close to the kinds of observation times that we currently have and all those things, then it might be worth taking a closer look. My guess is probably not, but this indicates that it might be worth taking a closer look.
Can I ask a quick clarifying question? Yeah, and I think you actually just answered it, but on like the previous, here, is the resolving power in terms of longer observation time because you're physically, moving, accessing lower frequencies and hence accessing the red spectrum, or because, yeah, so you're nodding, but I was wondering, or if it was because your increased SNR allows you to discern like the spectral shape of the overall.
In this case, but that's another great question. So in this case, all I'm looking at, I'm not calculating any signal to noise ratios. All I'm saying is, you know, we take data for, you know, 19 years or whatever it is, or some length of time. What frequencies do we have access to? And what is the inflationary spectrum doing at that frequency relative to some other spectrum, like white noise or supermassive black hole spectrum or supermassive black hole with a turnover?
Got it. Great. Thank you.
So not about signal to noise ratios or correlations or anything like that. The point being that, this is a very crude kind of, you know, back of the envelope estimates to see whether this is even interesting at all, right?
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
And so with a turnover, you know, it might be worth taking a closer look. But if there's no turnover, we'll never detect it. That's more or less what I wanted to say. Okay, let me very quickly, we don't have a lot of time left, so I want to talk about cosmic strings. So they form in phase transitions of the early universe, the cosmic strings, and they're also cosmic superstrings that are fundamental strings that are stretched to macroscopic scales by the expansion of the universe. They're characterized by a mass per unit length mu, and their energy scale is usually expressed in terms of the ratio of the mass scale squared of strings to the Planck scales squared, which is g mu. And there's a dimensionless ratio for gut strings, is 10 to the minus 6. Pulsar timing arrays are the most sensitive experiment to cosmic strings currently, and they give the best constraints with something like a g mu of 1.5 times 10 to the minus 11, which is a couple of orders of magnitude below the grand unified scale. So this is a plot from a paper where we show that we wrote a few years ago, where we show omega versus frequency. The gray lines here, the gray curves are different cosmic string spectra for different values of g mu, 10 to the minus 9, 10 to the minus 11, et cetera. And then on top of that, we plotted a few experiments, LIGO here on the right, LISA, the Big Bang Observer, and then a limit that we had from a few years ago. So this is not the common red noise detection. This is when we were still calculating upper limits, shown here in this with this wedge that says PTA, and then we can compare the supermassive black hole spectrum to the cosmic string spectrum here, and you can see that the slopes are very, very similar, and so that's a curious fact that I'll come back to later for cosmic strings and the 12.5 year datagrab results. Here are some plots from a paper by Blanco Villado et al. There's a number of papers on this topic, quite a few papers on this topic, and I just picked one to show you what the results are. And so here's curves assuming different emission mechanisms for cosmic strings, whether it's emission due to cusps or kinks or monochromatic, meaning cosmic string loops are just emitting at a single frequency. They all give very similar results. And so here you see the values of g mu and the emission models that are consistent. This is the innermost contour in the nanograph data set that are consistent with this. So something below 10 to the minus 10 in g mu is what's consistent with this measurement. In the case of cosmic superstrings, strings don't always reconnect, and that happens because these strings are the fundamental strings of string theory, so they interact with a cross section with a string coupling. The probability of interaction is proportional to the string coupling squared. In addition, in some of these models, there's extra dimensions, and even though the strings may appear to meet in three dimensions, they actually miss each other in the extra dimensions. The net effect of that is to reduce the overall reconnection probability and increase the density of strings. And so here's a plot that shows some of those results, and it looks like for many values of g mu, low reconnection probabilities are inconsistent with so superstrings are less consistent than regular field theoretic strings. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about cosmic strings. Finally, phase transitions and PTAs. The horizon size at the QCD phase transition time is about 10 kilometers, and that gets stretched out by cosmic ex, by the expansion of the universe, to about a parsec, which is 3 light years today. And this is about the wavelength of pulsar timing array gravitational wave sensitivity. And this is something that Ed Witten noticed back in the 80s. And so if there is any interesting physics that could possibly lead to gravitational wave generation, for example, if the QCD phase transition is first order or it involves first order phase transition in some way, then this could result in a signal that's potentially detectable by PTAs. And Chiara Caprini and Ruth Durer and I examined this quite a while back. And there's also been a few papers on this topic. And a recent one is by Nenaroff et al. But there's several others that deal with phase transitions in pulsar timing array data. All right, so to summarize the cosmological sources piece, we expect a detection of the background in the next few years. For cosmic strings, a big chunk of the parameter space is already ruled out by pulsar timing experiments. And when a detection is first made, as I showed, it may be difficult to distinguish between supermassive black holes and cosmic strings. And that's because of this, what I showed here, that the slopes of supermassive black holes and strings at the place where we are on the cosmic string spectrum seem to be quite similar. And so if you just look at the spectral index, that might not be enough to distinguish the two types of sources. LISA will certainly settle any lingering doubts. Let me show you here. So here's LISA. LISA goes on in 2034. If you turn it on and it gets swamped by gravitational waves, then we might have detected cosmic strings. If we see the regular sensitivity curve that we expect to see, then we know what PTAs have discovered is in fact supermassive black holes. There are other things though. It's not just about the spectral index. There's things like anisotropies, spectral features like individual supermassive black holes that pop out of the background. And so I think we can and should, of course, try to figure this out before LISA launches in 2034. Phase transitions, what I mentioned about phase transitions is, there's interesting physics at the QCD scale that could lead to a detectable, or if there is interesting physics at QCD scale, I should say, that could lead to a detectable gravitational wave signal in the PTA band. But we have potentially a similar problem if you look back at those spectra that might be hard to distinguish. And again, we have to go beyond the spectral index to try to figure this out. Things like isotropy in particular come to mind. I should mention that I think these are some details that haven't really been worked out. So this is kind of interesting ideas for people to think about. So how do we distinguish between different gravitational wave sources in the PTA band without waiting 15 years? All right, and the last thing I wanted to say was to talk about alternative theories of gravity, and I'm almost done. So general relativity has two polarizations, the plus and the cross polarizations, and gravitational waves that travel at the speed of light. But in general, metric theories of gravity have up to 6 polarizations and possibly modified dispersion relations. And if we found any evidence for these, that would immediately rule out general relativity. And this is hands down, in my opinion, the most interesting thing that we could do with gravitational waves is to uncover this. Now, I don't think the chances of that are very high, but it is definitely the most interesting thing that we could discover. So there are 6 polarizations, and I'm showing them here. This is some animations made by a graduate student here at OSU, Nima Lal. And so this is the plus polarization, the cross polarization. There's a breathing mode. There's a couple vector longitudinal modes, and then there's scalar longitudinal modes, which act along the direction of propagation. And there have been a number papers in the context of LIGO searches for these and also modified dispersion relations. But pulsar timing arrays present some advantages relative to ground-based detectors. Pulsar timing arrays are more sensitive to longitudinal modes than ground-based detectors, and that's because pulsar timing arrays don't operate in the long wavelength domain, meaning the gravitational wavelength of waves that LIGO detects is much larger than the detector. The opposite is true for pulsar timing experiments. In pulsar timing experiments, the gravitational waves, are 10 light years long, but the pulsars are 1,000 light years away, of that order. So that makes us much more sensitive to this kind of mode, and also these modes, these vector longitudinal modes. In addition to that, We have, 72 arms right now. So we can, there are six polarizations. So we can reconstruct these polarizations if they are there, if they are present. We can reconstruct them many times over using our 72 pulsars. Okay, so I am done. And I will just leave the slide up here. And I'm sorry that I didn't leave a lot of time for questions.
So thank you for the nice talk. Maybe first I'll ask if there are any questions online. If not, I see we have a couple in the room, so go ahead.
Hi, Zavi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, why don't you go ahead, Ben?
Are you talking to me, Ben?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right. Hi, Javi. I had a question. I mean, seeing as it looks like we're nearing a detection of gravitational waves, and a lot of the signals you were talking about are signals that are superpositions of many individual components. And so I guess we can't ever do better than just measuring power, because they're essentially Gaussian, the stochastic backgrounds will be Gaussian. But are there any examples of potential gravitational wave backgrounds, even stochastic, that are intermittent or that would have a non-Gaussian signature, where it would make sense to look at three-point correlations, for example? The answer is probably no, but
I'm trying to think here. I think the answer is no. I mean, so non-Gaussianities, there are no stochastic processes that are non-Gaussian. I mean, there are non-Gaussianities in the sense of, there are individual sources that stick up above the background. There are, we can detect, individual, say, bursts of gravitational waves, maybe if there's a flyby of two supermassive black holes, then those need to be sufficiently loud to be above the background, and those would be essentially non-Gaussianities. But as far as like a superposition of sources that turns on and then back off again, for example, I don't think that happens in, I don't think that happens in PTAs, and I don't know. I also don't think it happens in ground-based detectors, but maybe someone in the audience knows better.
Yeah, thanks.
Just a quick comment from the ground-based side. Yeah, we live in sort of the opposite regime, where for many astrophysical sources, we expect actually a very non-stationary, like popcorn-y background. And so, you might and gain some leverage on a signal that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for the comment. Yeah.
I have a question regarding the amplitude of the stochastic background from astrophysical sources. What population assumptions do you make for the amplitude? What population assumptions for the supermassive binary black holes do you make for estimating the amplitude of the signal?
Right. So that's another great question. So I'm not an expert on this. I'll start by saying that. I will tell you what I know. But basically, there are various ways of estimating the amplitude of the background. The ones that are most reliable, to my mind, come from simulations of structure formation and galaxy evolution in the universe, such as the Illustra simulation, for example. So these evolve, matter and dark matter, and track, galaxy formation and black hole growth at the centers of galaxies, and then from there you identify, what galaxies are merging, in your simulation, what masses of black holes live inside of those galaxies, and then what binaries you end up forming. Does that answer your question?
Partly, yeah, because I mean, you have this perfect problem, and also, I mean, if you really go for really big box sizes, then you do not get to resolve, Are you focusing on like small boxes with high resolution, including astrophysical feedbacks, to make an estimate of the background? Because I mean, I am partly involved in one of those estimates, and I am facing a challenge of making these estimates realistic to the best level from some simulation boxes, and I do not know how to make the realistic assumption to get a background signal.
Right. That's a great question. And the simulations that I mentioned are the ones that I'm most familiar with, but there's also analytic ways of getting at this answer, where, you know, for example, papers by, you know, I mean, the oldest ones are probably the oldest ones that I can think of. Well, I mean, the oldest estimate is from Sterl Finney from a very long time ago, which is an analytic estimate. And then based on those, a bunch of papers by Alberto Sassana and collaborators, Marta Volontari, and others, which are not, they're not simulation based. They're based on, they do take things like the M sigma relation, the measured M sigma relation, and other things that you can go out into the universe and measure, but the rest of the calculation is analytic. So there's no issues of like small box sizes in those kinds of calculations. And the nice thing is that all of them give very similar results, you know, to within an order of magnitude. The amplitude of the background that comes out of these calculations, whether you do simulations or where you do analytic estimates based on measurement, using measurements of black holes that we see in the universe and galaxy masses that we see in the universe, all those are pretty consistent. So I think the result for the amplitude of the background is pretty robust.
Great, thank you.
This is Ricardo speaking. A curiosity. So if the signal at 10 to the minus 80 hertz is due to some non-standard cosmological phase transition, so the temperature should be around 100 of GeV. Am I right? I just did the math now. I might have. So isn't it tantalizing that, you know, it corresponds to the kind of the Higgs? I mean that... there could point to some phase transition linked to the standard model.
So I think that the energy, that's another really good question. I think that the electroweak phase transition falls squarely in the LISA band.
Okay, so it would be two, three order of magnitude larger. That's even better. I mean, then there is plenty of room for non-standard model stuff.
Right. So PTAs just, I mean, this is a very fortuitous. PTAs fall in the QCD phase transition scale around there. LISA is in the electroweak phase transition scale. So that calculate, you know, how big is the horizon at the time of that phase transition? You know, you stretch it to today, and what gravitational wave frequencies do those turn into? QCD for PTAs.
So it's the MEV. So I did the math for LISA.
And LIGO falls somewhere in the desert of that. So between the electroweak phase transition and the grand unified phase transition, you know, there could be a number of phase transitions that, you know, go from a gut theory down to the electroweak. And that LIGO falls in the middle of that. So you'd have to explicitly write out something that we don't currently know about, some phase transitions that happen that land in the LIGO band. I don't know that there's any work on this, or at least I'm not familiar with any work on this for LIGO.
So it's in the MEV, the scale for PTA, MEV.
Yes, that's right.
Okay,
that's
right. Thanks.
Can I ask a question?
You've had your hand up for a really long time. Go ahead.
So first, before I get to my question, a side comment. I think as far as non-Gaussianity goes, and as far as fantasizing about inflation goes, we probably could get non-Gaussian signal out of that through something. Uh-huh. And I think Eugene Lim, Niyash, and Peter Atzed have this thing that they cross-correlate stochastic GWs with SKLM or CMB and stochastic background, and they make some prediction. But I don't know if it's for pulsar arrays or LISA or where. Regarding your polarization, the thing that you mentioned about if we have six polarization, are the the orientation of these arrays, are they now optimized to do, or are we, 72 seems a lot, so I assume it's
Yeah, that's another really good question. I mean, we don't get to choose where our pulsars are, unfortunately. We can certainly try to look for pulsars in certain parts of the sky to try to fill gaps, you know, and say an angular separation plot. You know, we might want to look at certain parts of the sky to make sure that we have a good coverage across all angular separations. We also want to look at certain parts of the sky to make sure we have sky coverage, because it turns out we're more sensitive to gravitational waves that are coming from behind our pulsars. But we don't really, it's hard to do optimizations because we, you know, pulsars are whatever they are. We do our surveys, our radio telescopes have access to whatever parts of the sky they have access to. And we, you know, we do our best to get all of the, you know, we basically, in our timing program, we have absolutely the maximum number of pulsars that it makes sense for us to have without, like, we can't really optimize any further other than we have as many pulsars as we can. Well, it's not quite true. I think we're going to probably in the next, you know, in the next 10 years, I think we might be able to go up to, and with new radio telescopes, we might be able to go up to say 200 pulsars, something on that order. And I think at that point, we will be making a more concerted effort to, you know, there's going to be the SKA in the Southern Hemisphere, hopefully the NGVLA in the Northern Hemisphere, or the DSA 2000, which is another fantastic facility, another fantastic radio telescope. And I think at that point, we'll have the opportunity to really think about the question of optimization a little bit more than we have so far. So far, honestly, what we've been doing is, you know, timing as many pulses as we can, no matter where they are in the sky. That has been our optimization.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
If there are no more questions, let's thank Xavier again.